So to start off with, could you share with me where you are from in the kingdom?
Yes, I'm currently residing in Jeddah.
Okay, and is that where your family is from in the kingdom, or you consider to be the family place?
Well, not really. It depends on how you look at it. I'm Lebanese, born and raised in Lebanon. I eventually moved to the United States of America for around 10 years of my life after I reached 18. And then from there, I moved here to the kingdom around 5 years ago. So my family here is with me, as in my wife and children. But as for my parents, then they remain in Lebanon.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And do you think that you were raised in what many would view as a conservative Muslim family?
On the contrary, I was raised in a very much Christian environment. My family in particular, we had absolutely nothing to do with Islam except that it was the official religion on our passports. But in essence, we really had no relationship with the religion whatsoever. There was a wake-up call at the when I was 11 years old, when my grandfather died, due to which my mother had this kind of spiritual awakening, which really didn't affect me personally much. I mean, I didn't share the sentiments with her, and so I remained to be in my, you can say, deviant ways. I really never practiced Islam at all. And when I went to the States, I actually became a Buddhist. And so I really went off track. I was a rapper, supposedly. I tried to be a rapper. I think I failed in that as well. But the idea was that I had really no relationship with Islam at all until around, I believe, 2005, was it, or 2006. It was around that time that Islam actually came to my life. And then, obviously, things changed drastically.
Okay. Gosh, thanks for sharing. I think that's fascinating, all the experiences that you went through before, as you say, coming around to Islam in 2005-2006.
Correct.
Okay. So, what kind of Islamic teachings and studies have you had?
Well, in that transitional phase back in the States, I wind up actually being exposed to different modes of Islam, not because the actual teachings vary, but because the application of people vary. And so I got bits and pieces and of everything. But eventually I came across a student of knowledge from Medina University who's from Hollywood. And ironically, I don't know if you've heard of Yusuf Estes. He's a famous Texan-American propagator of Islam. That's his son-in-law. Meeting him kind of really had an effect on me in the sense that he directed me towards what we can call the orthodox teachings of Islam, the unadulterated, authentic resources and what have you. So that really had a difference in my life. Thereafter, he also guided me to a masjid in Los Angeles, Masjid al-Mu'min. And there was a sheikh who had actually graduated from Saudi, from the University of Imam in Riyadh. And he was our teacher for some time before I migrated here. And I continue to acquire knowledge to the best of my ability through the scholars. And I'm currently in the process of getting my degree in Islamic studies. I'm a semester away. It's online. It's distance learning. But nevertheless, and I've been involved in the propagation of Islam ever since I came to the kingdom. And that kind of does have, it influences your thoughts and your dedication, because this is what I'm fully dedicated to nowadays. I work for that, around the clock.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can hear me typing or not, but I'm just typing away as you're talking.
I try to make myself slower. I keep forgetting that you're doing that.
Well, I think that we're doing okay, and I feel comfortable, and that I'm capturing. So, what prompted you to become what many will say is a spokesperson and create your series of videos on YouTube?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. It wasn't something that I necessarily planned for. Obviously, as a believer in the one God, we firmly believe in what is known as preordainment, destiny, decree. And so everything has been pre-decreed by the Creator. Nothing happens haphazardly or pure luck. What happened was back in the States, obviously there were different masajid, different mosques, who would often need someone who delivers the Friday sermon. And when I got involved in acquiring knowledge and being frequenting the masajid, at some point they couldn't find a person to deliver the sermon, and so some of the brothers suggested that I go ahead and do that. And so and so that was my first experience. And some people are naturally being the fact that I was a rapper, I was used to speaking before people. I had some sort of, you can say, self-confidence, I guess. Maybe it sounds vain now, but the truth is that my personality was one wherein I wanted to be a comedian. I wanted to be, I didn't mind being in the spotlight. And so that kind of was quite compatible with the process of inviting people or educating people in regards to Islam. This kind of personality, it does make a difference for the audience. So it was like that. The first time I gave the sermon, they said, hey, thank you, and you did a good job, and so, why don't you do this often? And so they gave me a slot. And from there on, it just became gradual. Now, when I moved to the kingdom and I started working, I worked in the Dawah Center. The Filipino community here, mostly reverts to Islam, also saw that I could be a potential speaker. So they gave me the platform to give him weekly lectures. And then one time a brother came and said, hey, do you mind if I shoot this and if I have it on video? I said, by all means, be my guest. And so he started doing so. And next thing you know, he said, well, I have the video. If you ever want to put it up on YouTube, why not? I said, okay. And just one thing led to another, and next thing you know, we have a channel, and we have all these videos, and we have worldwide spectators, and alhamdulillah, audience, and it was just one thing, that it was like domino effect. It wasn't planned for, at least by human effort, but it was planned for, we believe, divinely, and so there you have it. It just happened like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
a good reaction.
Yeah, well, I'm going to deviate just a little bit from my questions.
That's
because,
fine.
I know how we all want to use our strengths and talents when we want to, especially, deliver a message. So I'm curious, have you ever used your rapping to actually even do a rap trying to appeal to some of the youth and younger generation?
Well, to tell you the truth, it crossed my mind. But the issue with it is that besides being controversial, we have a principle in Islam, which is that of weighing the harm and the benefit. And we always have to do that when we approach such issues that may be somewhat delicate and may kind of bring about good things, and also it may create some sort of evil in the community. And so when it came to this issue, we had to apply the same principle. Yes, there's some benefit in doing so. However, there's also much harm associated with it. Namely, that it keeps the youth in this mentality of being hip-hop stars idolizing hip-hop stars. And needless to say, it's sad to say that those who are on the scene are mainly drug users, womanizers, and people that brag about their jewelry and gold and what have you. And so we're trying to take away that image from the youth, because this is unhealthy for their spiritual life. And so my alternative has been and continues to be poetry. I am. If I'm self-proclaimed poet, I may be horrible in what I do, but nevertheless, I write poetry. It's on my Facebook page. I just wrote one a couple of days ago. I continue to write poetry, and I use it as an alternative. I'm still able to use my what I consider to be rhyming skills in a manner where I'm not necessarily presenting it on stage before an audience, whether it is, you know, singing it or having it on an album, because my main objective is to bring the youth and the Muslims to the seriousness that our religion teaches, while accepting the leeway which we have and the room for the lawful enjoyment and entertainment. But we don't want to kind of make it, you know, like a party around the clock. And so I try to replace or do the poetry as an alternative for the actual rap. Because the rap, which is being done actually by different Muslims now, has brought some benefit. But the problem is that it got these youth so attached to these individuals that they actually missed out on the objective of their message. So they became obsessed with their looks and the way they deliver and their personalities. And the message which they're trying to deliver to them in the actual lyrics was lost. It was lost in the process, so it defeated the very purpose of why they rapped to begin with. So based on their, I'm not going to say it failure, but based on the failure of this method, I kind of decided to leave it alone and stick to my public lecturing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for that explanation, and that does clear up in my mind, and I understand. So, how do you think your videos are received within Saudi Arabia?
Well, you know, I have conflicting opinions from the people. It's amazing, actually. It's one of these things that amazes the human mind. How can a single person or a single message can be interpreted in so many different ways that it creates people that dearly love you and cherish you, and people that dearly hate you and despise you, even though you're saying this very same thing. And so really, the people in Saudi are divided into different categories. Now, the lectures which I deliver are done in a hospital, and the audience which is present there is a combination of nationalities. You can say the United Nations is there. We have the Westerners from America, Britain, Canada, South Africa, what have you. Then we have the subcontinent brothers from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and so forth. Then we have Arabs, and Saudis, Lebanese, Syrian, Egyptian. Then we have the Filipinos. Then we have Indonesians. So it's like actually a mixture of cultures. All of them have been coming for these lectures for around 3 years now. These public lectures, and we're going on the fourth, inshallah, and they're quite delighted. They look forward to them, and it's they bring their family, and to them this is like going out with the family for what would be superior to just a dinner. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, there are some individuals, whether locally or internationally, who may disagree with the message as they perceive it to be, as it happened with others, that it may be somewhat strict and conservative and kind of narrow-minded or things of the sort. And so they prefer the other understanding of Islam, the more modern, I guess, application understanding of Islam. So they don't find these lectures to be as entertaining because they feel that they kind of infringe upon their freedom, and it makes things difficult when, according to them, they're supposed to be much easier. Of course, I have answers for that, but I think maybe the time will come for that.
Okay, and I'd like to add into that is what hospital can one go to receive one of your lectures?
It's the International Medical Center.
International Medical Center, and is that in Jeddah?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and when do you deliver the lectures?
Well, they're done on Mondays, different Mondays. There isn't a fixed schedule. What the people can do is once they subscribe to the website or the Facebook page, then whenever there's a lecture, that is automatically updated with a flyer and all the details. So that's one way. And the other way is that they can give me their cell phone number, and we have an SMS service wherein we will text the people who are on the list whenever there's a lecture.
Okay, lucky. And then, how do you think your videos have been received from the outside world, and specifically from the Western world?
Well, the good news is that the positive reaction to the lectures actually exists primarily in the UK and in the United States. You know, believe it or not, for whatever reason, you will think it should be the other way around. But I guess there's this kind of thirst and eagerness to practice Islam in this manner, so that the actual reaction is beyond beyond what I ever anticipated. I get emails and invitations and phone calls from worldwide people, you know, just to say thank you and we appreciate it and we want you to be here and we can't wait for you to come give lectures and so on and so forth. And so there's a huge, alhamdulillah, and I praise Allah, I'm not, you know, the praise belongs to Allah because He's the one who has made all this happen. There's a huge crowd and following out there for these lectures, way, way greater and than the one which is actually local. As the hall can only accommodate around maybe 100-something people. But the viewers on YouTube are in the thousands. And so, you know, it's easy to circulate a video, but it's not easy to come to the actual physical location and you know, watch the lecture live. So the greater audience exists in the Western world. And I would say the reaction is 80 to 20. I mean, 80%. Is positive and people appreciate it, and there's 20% that obviously don't necessarily appreciate the content of the lectures.
Mm-hmm. Well, would that perhaps say that there may be a trend that Islam is, the practice of Islam in the West is becoming more conservative?
Yeah, that's evident. That's evident. That's clear. If one you know, is up to date with the world news and events, it becomes clear that Islam is actually on the rise, and the practicing Islam is on the rise. Even in the recent revolutions and uprising in the Arab world, you're finding that now during their elections and the people are calling for Islam and demanding that it is the governing force of their countries, even though that wasn't necessarily their objective before. And so similarly, and perhaps greater than that, it's the case in the Western world. There is that kind of thirst, obviously because of the environment. The environment does make one, it's like if someone had a belief in something, and then all those around him believed otherwise, he feels that he has to hold on to his belief even more so that one can be firm. This is, I think it's a human nature, be it Islam or it could be anything else for this matter. A person will find strength in finding steadfastness upon that way, whatever that way could be, because the environment kind of imposes this behavior on them. That doesn't necessarily encourage what some of the Muslims do in the Western world in terms of rioting and protesting and the protests and demonstrating and destroying public properties and raising, the signs and posts saying that this and that and cursing the people out. This is un-Islamic behavior. And I, as one who follows strictly the teachings of Islam, do not agree with the manner in which some of the Muslims behave in the Western world, wherein they ruin the image of Islam and they misrepresent us and they make us seem like we're uncivilized people who don't really aren't able to communicate with the world. and that we're close-minded and things of the sort. So even though you know, Islam is being, people are trying to adhere to it, you know, in the Western world, that should also be done in moderation, as per the Islamic teachings, and not per emotionalism, because many people act emotionally, and that is not necessarily Islamically endorsed.
Okay, thank you for those points. Now, do you think many non-Muslim Westerners are capable of understanding the tenets of Islam? Why or why not?
Absolutely. I believe they are able to understand the tenets of Islam. Now, of course, some of the specific teachings of Islam, like the video about the honeymoon and things of the sort, which you may have come across, these ones, obviously, it's difficult to digest them, because the audience who's being addressed is different. And we will go to that in a little bit, I guess. But for now, if we speak about the tenets, as in the belief in the oneness and uniqueness of the Creator of the heavens and the earth, and to believe that He has angels whom He created from light, and to believe in the messengers whom He sent, and that these messengers were sent with scriptures, and that there's a day of judgment wherein people will be recompensed for their behavior and actions, and then that everything has been decreed by God. This is something that every human being, be it Western or otherwise, should relate to, because we believe as Muslims this is part of our natural disposition. We were created by default in this fashion. It is not something that is foreign to us. Rather, it is foreign or abnormal to reject it. Because everything indicates that the existence of God is something undeniable, and that God is obviously so intelligent, so wise, that He wouldn't create the creation and leave Him unattended. So there must be some objective behind this creation. Similarly, no director or owner of a hospital would build a hospital without having a goal to serve patients. And then he wouldn't hire employees and then tell them what their job is. If an owner of a hospital were to do that, were to build a hospital, hire people, however, he doesn't intend to serve patients, nor does he tell each employee what his or her job is, we will say this person is a lunatic who has wasted a lot of money and manpower. So if a human being would not do that, then God will not create the universe in its complexity, and then will create human beings to live upon it, give him intellect, give him eyesight, give him hearing ability, give him all these unique features, which, you know, even though they share them with the animals in some way, but not in the ultimate sense, it is not all in vain. It could not all be in vain. So if it is not in vain, that must mean there's an objective. And that objective is going to be analyzed with these senses we were given. Revelation is the biggest evidence. So the Quran clearly lays out these teachings. And if one is coming from Christianity, then one can find the similar teachings in the Bible. If one is coming from Judaism, then they will also find the same thing in the Torah. Even among Hinduism and Buddhism, which are not necessarily divinely based scriptures, religion, still you will find that they share some of these ideas, indicating that this is very normal for a human being. So I believe the Western world is able to adopt these tenets. However, there may be some obstacles in the way which one must first remove before one is able to submit accordingly.
Mm-hmm. I'm just finishing up typing here.
Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Now, the next question that I have, and I know this is certainly a sensitive one, but I think it's very important to this interview, is, do you believe a different form of Islam is practiced in Saudi Arabia as compared to Muslims who are practicing Islam in the West? Why or why not?
Yes, I believe that there is a difference, primarily because of the context. The context, what I mean by that here, geographically and historically and in terms of the government. obviously that will have an effect and an influence on the behavior of the very Muslims in their respective countries. So there is a difference between the Islam being practiced here and practiced elsewhere in term, generally speaking. However, when we go into the, if we look at it from an individual basis, then I believe that the true teachings of Islam are being equally applied within the kingdom and outside the kingdom. It really depends on the individual, because the truth and the sources, the evidences are available. They are available, and one has access to them anywhere one is. And so it really depends on their view of how, to what extent do they want to adhere to these teachings, or to what extent do they actually understand them and comprehend them adequately and correctly. That will make a difference. But the living in a Muslim country, or living in Saudi Arabia with some of the rules which are here, of course these rules, some are in favor of and some are disagree with them, but I believe they ultimately have an effect on the society at large. And sometimes if the people don't understand the wisdom behind these restrictions, then they may rebel, which we've seen already. And so that shows you that you may bring a Westerner, and this is the case. I mean, I know many of them here in the kingdom, primarily or mainly English language instructors, and they simply love it. And they came here for the very reason, the very objective of being able to live Islam, in the 100%. And you'll find others who live here who just can't wait to get out so they can live their life the way they want to live it, because they feel that in Saudi they don't have such freedom.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. What do you think is the single most important aspect of Islam a Westerner should understand?
Well, the most important aspect they should understand is that the universality and the compatibility of Islam. Islam is universal. It is not the religion of the Arabs. It is not the religion of the Indonesians. It is not the religion of a minority. It is a way of life which is suitable for every human being from now until the end of time. And so that, I believe, is important to understand, because there seems to be a misconception in this regard. Islam is universal because the message is universal. It is not restricted to a group of people or a geographical location or a single person. Had Islam been a religion which opposed previous scriptures, which denied the prophets which came before it, then one may wonder whether Islam is actually a universal religion. But the truth is, Islam it calls its followers to believe in Adam and Eve, and to believe in Abraham and Noah and Jacob and Joseph and David and Solomon and Jesus and Moses and all the prophets and the messengers whom God sent. And we believe in all of them equally. We honor them, we venerate them, and we don't describe them with anything which undermines their greatness and their status. And so that is very much universal. The salvation which Islam provides is also universal. It is not restricted to the to something happening to a particular individual wherein you had to live or you had to be alive during his time or before his time to receive that blessing. Because if we were to say that, for instance, one individual, if you believe in this one individual, then your sins will be forgiven or expiated, then what happened to the people that preceded that person who never got the chance to believe in him or disbelieve in him? And if they get that privilege of getting their sins forgiven as well, then on what basis? Because they may have rejected him had they been alive during his time. And so there's some sort of injustice in this kind of observation here. Islam, on the other hand, says that salvation primarily lies on believing in the oneness of God and in the messenger whom he sent during that time. So anyone who maintains that, or even someone who lived in the jungle, didn't get the chance to interact with any messenger, no messenger was sent to him, then he is not liable in this sense, because he hasn't rejected anything. And per his natural disposition, he must have believed in God. It is irrational that he would think that the tree created him or the created the environment around him. So he would believe in this one God, even though he doesn't know much about him, because no scripture was available for him. But he will have that basic natural disposition with him. And so that is actually a source of salvation as well. So now anyone then, from the time of Adam until the end of time, if they believe in the one God, which is normal, and they believe in the messengers of God, all of them together, then they have salvation. And they don't have to depend on one particular individual. That is universality. Compatibility, Islam is compatible with all aspects of life. Yes, there are many different areas which Islam restricts. And some may complain and say, but you know, why is that? Why doesn't Islam allow us to do this or allow us to do that? And how come Islam wants to get involved in every little part of our life? Well, the basic and rational answer is, why were you created? If you believe you were created to entertain yourself until you die, then that idea is what is creating the problem. However, if your understanding is, I was created so I may be tested in this life in order to attain eternal happiness and bliss in paradise, then obviously I need to earn it. Similarly, no student can enroll in any university and miss out on classes and not pay the tuition and then not do any homework and then say, come on guys, I should just pass, you know. Why are you making it so difficult? Say, we're not making it difficult, but you enrolled in school and you know that there are things you have to do in order to get a degree. It doesn't happen while you're having a blast. You must restrict yourself and confine yourself to certain things which will enable you to attain this degree. So it's human nature to understand the idea that I must exert some effort in order to earn that which is great and will bring me happiness in life, because a degree can ensure a decent job and a good salary, and success is pretty much nowadays conditional to your qualifications and credentials. And so if we're looking at success in this very limited fashion, worldly success, which will end upon a person passing away, then how about that eternal success, which is is beyond any value or any number we can put on it? It's something beyond human recognition. It's priceless. And so if it's that valuable, then hey, you know, you have to take it easy in life. There are lawful things which are made available for you. God created for you. And he told you in the Quran, وَلَا تَنْسَ نَصِيبَكَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا. Don't forget your portion of the worldly life. But if that is going to become our main priority, and so we forget about the life to come and the preparation that is due, and then one will feel that, I'm being restricted. But in fact, that restriction is only there to help you succeed eventually, just like everything else in life.
Okay. I believe I do have most of that, and I thank you for that. So, there are practicing Muslims who do not agree with the guidance and instruction you provide on your series of videos. And some of these Muslims are in Saudi Arabia. They are Saudis. What do you say to them?
I say to them that first and foremost, I would like to first apologize to them in case I come off to be someone who's rude or insensitive. I don't mean that, but I guess during the time where I'm speaking, I truly believe in what I'm saying, and so it appears to some to be offensive or inconsiderate towards other people's feelings. So my apologies if this is how I come off. I don't intend to be this kind of person, but I believe that the truth sometimes is just a little, it's powerful. And if someone is not ready for the truth and they can't handle the truth, then they will react negatively. What happens is, like I said, I think the culture and the history of a person, his upbringing, plays a major role. Someone like myself, who's lived the lavish life, who's followed my desires in the ultimate sense, who's been out in different countries in the world, and eventually coming to Islam, obviously my adherence or my effort to adhere will be different from someone who was born into the religion and they practice it more of ritualism and culturalism rather than spiritualism and being convinced in it. I think really that's what it boils down to. Some people who don't agree, if they present the evidence as to why they don't agree, then great, we can have a scholarly debate or dialogue and see which position is stronger according to the textual evidence. No issues there. But if their displeasure is based on, I think that, I don't like that, then this is just, it's basically the truth conflicting with their choices and they feel intimidated that someone is kind of imposing on them what they know is correct, and so they're unable to react in a positive way. Not because of the fallacy of what is being said, but it's probably because they have been practicing Islam in such a habitual, ritualistic way that when the actual truth came associated with the spirituality behind it, they just couldn't handle it. And they just can't handle it. That's it. Otherwise, if there are views which I hold that are debatable, then the Islam requires of me to go back to the truth whenever I find it. And I do not claim infallibility. I definitely make mistakes like any other speaker. And there are things which I say at times and then I realize later that I was wrong in that regard. And so I eventually have to explain myself and correct myself before the people. That has been done many times if one follows my lectures. And so it depends on the validity or the legitimacy of the one objecting. Are they objecting because they have a valid Islamic reason to do so? Or is it because it just conflicted with their preferences and their personal choices, even though they're not endorsed Islamically? If it is the first, then hey, they are entitled to that. I respect the difference of opinion. I admire their individuality and the fact that they want to have something of their own. No problems at all. We're totally compatible. But if they're rejecting on the basis of their own weaknesses, then that's not becoming. It's not befitting at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I hope you have a glass of water beside you.
I don't, but I have a cough which doesn't seem to abandon me after Hajj every year. It sticks around for a couple of months, so I just have to wait for it to go away. Water will probably make me cough even more. But thank you for your concern.
You're welcome. Okay, do you ever view your guidance as strict or extreme? And an example is like advising newlywed couples not to honeymoon outside of Muslim countries.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, we go back to the older issue. It depends on from which angle you approach the matter. If you're approaching it from a cultural, kind of modern, lenient angle, then you will find my view to be extreme, extremely extreme, and very much, unacceptable. How dare he? How could he? What audacity does this person have to say, that what people have been doing and continue to do to be un-Islamic? And I understand that view exists. However, if we go back to the core teachings of Islam, which is what every Muslim is expected to do. Of course, non-Muslims are not expected to do this because they haven't embraced the religion. But the Muslims themselves must understand that, what has been revealed is sufficient. And what is brought from outside sources is not part of our practice. Had it been acceptable or allowable, then God wouldn't have forgotten about it. It would have been legislated, like many different things which Islam actually acknowledged and approved. Practices which were among the Christians, practices which were among the Jews, and practices which were among the Arab pagans. There are some practices which Islam actually acknowledged, it endorsed, and it did not violate in any way, shape, or form. Whereas there are other practices which Islam nullified and explicitly said to the people that you may not engage in such actions because they contradict the message of Islam. The honeymoon is a classic example. The idea of the honeymoon, as I mentioned in my short clip, is one which is brought from another religion. It is not something that is merely cultural. And so that in and of itself creates a problem, because Islam basically has, the teachings are so comprehensive and so complete that it doesn't leave any room for any outside sources to kind of integrate themselves into the religion. And so on the one hand, we have the issue of the actual practice being brought from a scripture, and from another scripture, not the Qur'an. And the Qur'an did not approve it, as opposed to other practices which the Qur'an and the Sunnah, the traditions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, approved. Secondly, we have to look at the same principle I mentioned to you earlier, Mrs. Carroll, which is that of the weighing the benefits and the harms. Now, we're not against a newlywed couple to go out and enjoy themselves, because it is ludicrous to say that they should not. Because the whole idea of marriage, actually, as Islam teaches, is marriage is supposed to bring about love, compassion, happiness, and the husband and wife are expected to be clothing to one another. Just like a garment covers you completely and protects you from the outside world, a husband is supposed to play that role for the wife, and the wife is supposed to play that role for the husband. So that is totally Islamic. The issue is, if we go outside and into places where vice is prevalent, and where people, unfortunately, wind up taking not only a vacation from work, but they take a vacation from God. And so when they go out there, everything goes. Now, based on knowing what happens, the issue was addressed in the manner in which you heard. Because truthfully speaking, if people wanted to go out, we said for something that is beneficial for them spiritually, and within the margins and the limitations of the religion, by all means. And you don't have to call it honeymoon, because that name in and of itself has an origin. And so, like we said, there may be no honey where you're going, or you may not even see the moon. And so the name in itself being brought from an outside source is now not necessary. And that's as far as the name is concerned. But as far as the actual event, if it's going to entail people disobeying God and compromising their religious commitment and violating what they know should not be violated, then such things should not happen at all, because a wedding and marriage is something where you anticipate blessings from God. In fact, you are in a dire need to receive God's blessings in this marriage, because the rest of your life is pretty much conditional to the success of your marriage. And everybody knows that two people that don't get along, a husband and wife, their lives will become hell. Their children's life will become hell. So we look at it as you need the assistance and support and the blessings of God so much in these early stages. The last thing you want to do is begin it by disobeying God. And you cannot possibly go to any Western country and stay in any five-star hotel or otherwise without having to see alcohol being served and people being dressed a particular way, which Islam or even Christianity doesn't really allow. And you wind up being in this environment which will inevitably have an effect on you. It will inevitably, change your views in some way. And so out of seeking to protect the Muslims from falling into that, the advice was given accordingly. Because we look at the context, we look at the whole picture, not just that one element, but many things are taken into consideration, and from there the scholars are able to deduce what could be lawful and what could be unlawful, even though there isn't an explicit text in its regards. I mean, there doesn't have to be an ayah in the Quran which says do not go for honeymoons, or a narration from the Prophet. But this is understood and deduced from the principles of Islam, which were laid down specifically to preserve and protect the Muslim from anything which will divert him from the path leading to salvation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you see as a perfect Islamic state?
Well, the perfect Islamic state is one where justice is served, where people are not oppressed, and where the one true God is worshipped in the ultimate sense. This is what actually Islam always strove for and continues to strive for. Islam is against oppression. It's against the sense of terrorizing people, as many Muslims suffer today actually at the hands of others. Yes, we have some amongst the Muslims who misrepresent us in this sense, and they act in a way that contradicts the teachings of Islam, such as killing innocent people and blowing up different places and things of the sort, which are not endorsed in Islam in any way, shape or form. The Islamic State is one where everyone living there is given their right. And you see, if one reads and explores the history of Islam, one will find that when the Muslim Empire was spreading, the people of other faith were not forced, never, by the sword to embrace Islam. Rather, they were allowed to maintain their faith if they wanted to do so. They were provided protection under the Islamic State in turn for some taxes that they would pay. And then they were allowed to keep their churches or their the monasteries or whatever they had, which was of a religious symbol for them, irrespective of the religion, they were allowed to keep and maintain, and no Muslim was allowed to attack them and harm them in this fashion. And so this is the ideal Islamic State, where the one God is worshipped, and the people who wish to do otherwise are not basically harassed because of that, and where justice is served so that what God revealed is the governing law of the world, not man-made laws which often oppress human beings. So this is really a fine point here, that very often the laws which continue to change, even though they're supposed to be compatible with the citizens and civilians, in reality, very often they conflict with the people's freedom of choice and freedom of speech and things of the sort. And so they're not given this kind of privilege. For example, just to give you an example, in Lebanon, where I'm from, if a person rents an apartment from the owner, and then that owner of the apartment decides that he wants his house or apartment back, which they own, they cannot, and they do not have the right to make that person, the renter, leave unless they pay him a huge amount of money, sometimes equivalent to half of the value of the house, depending on the number of years this person resided in this place. Then they become so fixed in this place that you cannot actually take them out unless you pay them a huge sum of money. But you're only asking someone to give you back your property, which you had rented. So this is a law. This is a law which, in fact, which is a form of oppression against the owner's right. You own this place, you have the freedom to rent it for 1 year, or 5 years, or 10 years, and at the end of the day, when you're done and you want it back, you're supposed to be able to get it back. But in Lebanon, the law does not support you. And so you cannot get your property back, because someone has lived there for so many years. It's like, come on, how are you going to make him leave now? This is the rationale. How are you going to make them leave after all these years? So the person gets to stay. So these laws very often actually are, even though some of them are quite decent, and they do serve humanity, many of them don't. So the Islamic State will be one where the creator of the heavens and the earth, who knows what he created and knows what is suitable for them and what is ideal for them, is the one who legislates. And then they go by that legislation. Now, perfection is not possible, and error is going to happen, and mistakes will occur, you know. But at least the people, the human beings, are given their God-given freedom, which he had given them from the time he created them.
Okay, I've got that. The next question is, how do you feel about the many expatriates of differing faiths in Saudi Arabia? should they be replaced by Saudi?
I wouldn't say that. First, let's be frank. The idea of the non-Muslims being in Saudi is a controversial aspect of the religion, concerning which the scholars of the kingdom themselves, the permanent committee of issuing verdicts, and the senior scholars have already issued verdicts in this regard, explained public, and everybody has access to them. So there's no secrets there. The idea of, and I am a student of knowledge, or even lesser than that, and so to address issues of this magnitude is beyond my level of knowledge, because they are extremely sensitive, and they require someone who is very much aware of intricate details of the religion, something which I'm not necessarily experienced in. I'm good at, or I may be good in, presenting a basic idea of Islam and the basics of Islam to a non-Muslim. But these issues are based on textual evidences, and these textual evidences have different interpretations. What we can agree to, however, is that this idea of replacing Saudi with someone else, merely because that person is Saudi and the other person is not, may not necessarily be a form of justice. Islam requires that the person's credentials and their qualifications are that which determines or the determining factor in whether they get this particular job or they don't. And so just generally, like a blanket statement, like all expatriates must leave and Saudis must be the ones running business all the way, this is not really feasible, and it may not be just either. And so it should be a matter of people's qualifications. But obviously, what we can say is that in any country, the residents or the citizens of that country are usually given particular privileges that are not given to others. And I don't think there's a single country in the world, as far as I know, that is an exception to the rule. Yes, they may treat both with justice. But again, this is according to the Constitution. And so they make a distinction between a resident, an illegal resident, a citizen, and so on and so forth. And they do not share all the privileges in the ultimate sense. And so similarly, any residents of a country, any citizens of a particular country, should be given particular rights that are due to them, because this is their homeland. And if other people were to, kind of take over, then they would have nothing to do. And that's not fair for them, because at the end of the day, other people are guests. So there must be a really, a nice, balanced way to deal with this issue, so that really the local people are not oppressed in a sense that they have no role to play. They should be trained, they should be helped, and they should be given positions, provided that they've earned them, provided that they're working hard, provided that they're being helped to reach these, higher goals. I think it has to come from both the Saudis themselves and the expatriates. There must be some collaboration between them so that everyone would become successful, not a one-sided approach.
Okay. All right, thank you. The next question is, what do you think Saudi Arabia will be like within 5 years? For example, do you think there would be a stricter form of Sharia imposed, or do you think women may be driving?
I cannot really tell, because we believe that the future is in the hands of Allah, and I cannot tell the future. And I'm not this person who claims to have this, wisdom that I can foresee the future and what things will turn out to be. I'm actually clueless on whether things will be improving in a sense, or whether things will be going the other direction. I wouldn't really be able to tell, and I'm being very honest here. I really don't know. It is possible that women will be driving. It is possible they may not be driving. It's totally unknown to me what would happen within the next 5 years.
Okay. And do you think it's good for Saudi society, and especially Saudi women, that they now have greater employment options, such as working in department stores?
Islam does not prohibit women from working. In fact, there are areas where only women should be working, and it shouldn't be men shouldn't be playing these roles. So because Allah made men and women different, they're not the same, and so each has a role to play. So the idea of Islam being against women working is a fallacy and a propaganda and a misconception that is often spread about Islam. What Islam does, however, is it provides guidelines wherein the man and the woman are protected while going about their daily work and what have you. And so both men and women may work, obviously. And if women are being given the opportunity to work, provided that they are being protected from men, because many people think that it's oppressing the woman. But the truth of the matter is, it is liberating the woman. Islam, as opposed to what culturally may be understood, Islam honors and values women to such a degree that she is equivalent to a diamond, a jewel, something which should be protected and preserved. Subsequently, you find that there's always some man who is supposed to be responsible for this woman. Not as in one who imposes on her things, even though some may do that. I don't deny that. And that's their own personal choices. But in a sense that some man is responsible for the well-being of this woman, for protecting her from the environment, which is hostile. We know that in some countries, a woman is raped every 9 seconds. On university campuses, a place of education, a place of, you know, where you think people would be noble, at least enough not to do this. And women get raped in school, in universities, wherever you go, on the streets. It's a wild and phenomena because the women there have not been protected in the same manner that Islam protects their women. This is being frank, at least my observation. So the idea of this thing is that this woman is protected, because we know there are men out there who are hunting for women. And there are men there who are crazy. And there are men there who are sick. And there are men there who are sexually fascinated with women. And so paving the way for them, where women become an easy prey, is a problem for the woman before it is a problem for the man. It's a problem for both, for the society at large. So the idea behind these things is to protect the woman from these forces, these evil forces. Once that is there, then a woman could be a doctor, she could be a nurse, she could be whatever it is that is suitable for her, as long as she is being provided with her right of being treated like a queen. I know this sounds, maybe some will listen to say, yeah, right, give me a break here. We see the news, we read the news, say, yeah, but what you see is media a propaganda. Don't you know that, you know, some of these, TV stations or these news media, whatever, the news, different news, they go hunting and fetching for some Afghani woman who was raped by her cousin, and then they say that now she's forced to marry him. They bring these odd incidents, which are not Islamic, but obviously because she's a Muslim, she's from Afghanistan, so that becomes an Islamic problem, and they put this before the people. And so when the people hear me saying the Muslim is a queen, the Muslim woman is a jewel, they may think I'm just lying. But the truth is, I'm not. And you can ask women who are treated in this way. Now, I know that not every woman gets that treatment. Yes, and there are many cases where, because of the ignorance of men, women are mistreated, women are oppressed, women are subjugated, women are put in a position which Islam did not really put them in. But that becomes a cultural problem, it becomes a social problem, it becomes a problem with men in particular, not following the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad in terms of how to treat women, peace be upon him. It becomes an issue of other than Islam. Whatever mm-hmm. It is other than Islam. Otherwise, a woman may work, provided that she is protected. She is protected from the evil forces that exist in the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And also, since we've talked before about your YouTube channel, What is your channel for anyone who's interested and would like to watch your videos?
Yeah, my YouTube channel is One Way to Paradise. So obviously you will type up youtube.com/onewaytoparadise. There are no digits, no spaces, no symbols. So that would, you spell it out, O-N-E-W-A-Y-T-O-P-A-R-A-D-I-S-E. So there's a website, okay. onewaytoparadise.net, and the YouTube okay. channel, One Way to Paradise, and the Facebook is One Way to Paradise, and the we pretty much have One Way to Paradise.
Twitter, okay.
All that good stuff.
Okay, and Twitter also. I'm putting all this down for you.
Yeah, but the Twitter one, there's one way. The two is written with the number two. The numeric
okay.
two. Only, okay. that's an exception to the rule. The other ones, it's just the letters.
Okay, I've got that. And, gosh, this is fast today. Are there any other additional comments that you'd wish to add, that you'd wish to say?
Yes, I don't know whether what I said earlier was documented, but I would like to again thank you, Mrs. Carol Fleming in particular, for your courteous consideration and for allowing me to have this interview. I find it as a valuable opportunity to be able to possibly address some of the misconceptions which existed because of the videos which have been circulating on the net, and at least it gave me the chance to put in my two cents, as they say, in a more comprehensive way. Again, for all the viewers or readers, I apologize if they've ever been offended by anything I said. I do wish to explain that the context and the audience always make a difference. And this whenever we read other people's comments, if I go to any YouTube channel or watch any video of any person of any other religion, and I see him saying or I hear him saying something, I must also take into consideration the context. Who was he speaking to? And what was the context of his speech? Because if we don't do so, then we may wind up wronging other people. But obviously, mm-hmm. even a priest in the church, he will address his Christian audience in a way different than he would if he had a bunch of Muslim guests coming over to the church to hear him out. Or if he were to go to the wherever else and address them. The speech will change, the tone of voice will change, the content will change, not as hypocrisy, but as just the being factual and being able to convey to the people what their minds are able to understand. And so I think that as a formula in life would make things easier for all of us, and would at least bring some harmony between us human beings who live on this earth.
Okay. Well, I certainly also want to thank you for allowing me to interview you and ask you all these different questions. And I certainly hope that when the interview is posted on the blog, that you'll have the opportunity to look in and see what comments individuals have said in response. And, you know, I would love to have your own follow-up comments on the blog, to the blog comments as well.
Yeah, inshallah, I'll do that.
That sounds wonderful. And again, I want to thank you, and I just wish that you have a wonderful day, and the weekend will be starting tomorrow evening, and that you have a great weekend too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and all the best to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.